Hi everybody, today is Friday, July 11th, 2025, and our friend Dmitry Orlov is back with us. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Good to be with you.
Let's start with your website. Let us know about your website and how can we support your work.
Go to the URL on your screen, boosty.to/ClubOrlov, and there's some free stuff there, and the rest is available through a very moderately priced subscription, which is mostly for face control. I publish a couple of articles a week. The last one is on the Iranian victory over Israel in the United States, in case you are not entirely clear what it all means. I explain it in excruciating detail. So hope to see you there.
So, Dmitry, we had the, I think it's appropriate to talk about BRICS and BRICS Summit here in Brazil. And if you were to mention the new movement or the new attitude or somehow the progress in terms of the way that BRICS is trying to deal with the United States, how did you find this summit in Brazil?
The only interesting thing is that the new development bank is the new non-toxic currency clearinghouse for all of BRICS. And that's a huge development. The new development bank, or the BRICS bank, is going to grow by an order of magnitude. It's already in the billions. It's going to be probably in the tens and hundreds of billions. Of transaction of loans a year, development loans. That's probably the most important and the most popular at the moment part of BRICS. Other than that, it's just a platform for bilateral relations. We don't know how many deals were made by all these people who got together. The public face of it is, you know, to put it bluntly, boring. There's nothing for the journalists to talk about. It's all about the details. The devil is in the details and being handled. And so that's really all that we need to know as far as what happened.
The main issue, one of the main issues was during the summit was the tariffs and the way that the United States is putting tariffs. We've learned that in the aftermath, the United States has put 50% tariffs on Brazil, by the way. And how somehow during the summit, Brazil was so much cautious about the way that they were trying to put out the condemnation against the attack on Russia and Iran. But you see Donald Trump coming out and in favor of one of the candidates here in Brazil and trying to somehow interfere in internal policies of Brazil and putting tariffs on Brazil. Do you think that even by backing down, by somehow being more cautious toward the United States, that it doesn't seem that going to work with the Trump administration?
I don't think it matters. Trump does one insane thing after another, and the only sane element of it is the insider trading that goes on. So he says he'll impose tariffs, markets tank. His people buy up a bunch of futures and a bunch of stocks on the cheap. And then he postpones the tariffs by 60 days or whatever, or cancels them, or says that people are queuing up to kiss his ass or whatever. And of course, the futures rebound and the stocks rebound and it's time to sell. And then they do it again. So basically, they're bleeding the system. But what they're also doing is destroying the American economy. But they don't care about it because the American economy is a dead man walking anyway. They don't really care about it. They just want to escape with their wealth. And so with Bolsonaro, that's just kind of a personal vendetta that Trump seems to have. Brazil is bad because his friend Bolsonaro got thrown out. And that's bad. And therefore, they're going to have huge tariffs. And it doesn't matter that Brazil is about the only country, major country in the world, that runs trade deficits with the United States as opposed to trade surpluses. So for some petty personal issue, Trump is killing the golden goose, as it were, by killing Brazil trade with the United States. Well, what is Brazil going to do? Well, if the Brazilians are smart, they're going to start de-emphasizing the trade with the United States. And I hope that they're doing that.
Last time I checked, Dmitry, the import and export from the United States and to the United States are quite similar for Brazil. It's somewhere like $42, $43, and $47 billion. That doesn't, if Brazil decides to go in the same direction, that doesn't affect that much, influence that much the Brazilian economy, in my opinion. And do you feel that it was something symbolic? It was something because he wants to do something to show his support to Bolsonaro, as you've mentioned? Nothing beyond that?
No, it's whatever happened to his brain that morning. You know, it's unpredictable. You know, he does one thing and then he does the opposite 2 days later. He's like, basically, he's a Joe Biden with a different diagnosis. But they're both psychiatric patients. So we have to keep that in mind. We shouldn't be reading too much into what Trump does or doesn't do, because he's not all there. He's an old guy who thinks that he's won. And if he's not winning, then it's time to change the rules in his head. And he keeps doing that over and over again. He's friends with Putin. He's angry with Putin. He loves Putin. He hates Putin. You know, this is not girls in junior high school. This is like an old guy who's losing his marbles. So don't even worry about it.
When it comes to Indonesia, Dmitry, Indonesia became a full member of BRICS. And we know that Malaysia, Vietnam, these are huge countries, huge economies, and these are the future. Do you feel that BRICS, despite having, as you've mentioned, their differences, they're trying to somehow deal with each other to the way that they can condemn, they can go against some sort of move on the part of the United States in terms of Iran and Russia, what has happened, and they were condemning at this summit, they were condemning the attacks on Iran and Russia. But after all, when it comes to their differences and the way that they're trying to get along with each other, do you find it somehow improving as time goes by, or we still have those differences coming bolder than before?
Well, there are no scandals to report within BRICS. It's a boring organization, and most of what goes on is bilateral. And it's basically a talking shop where people are free to do whatever people want to do when there are no Europeans or Americans in the room. It's so refreshing and liberating that is a reason enough to keep that organization going. But it's got a lot of benefits for its members coming up, and New Development Bank is one of them. So Indonesia is a fast-growing economy. Of course, it interacts with all of the other countries in the region, and that has nothing to do with what the United States would like. It's unrelated.
In here in Brazil, they were somehow optimistic about the future of BRICS and the way that maybe a SWIFT system, a new SWIFT system, something similar can come out big and as a big news, as something that can change the communications between the countries that are so much connected, that's so much dependent on the United States. Do you feel that we're going to achieve that? We're going to have something like SWIFT, something, a communication line that would facilitate the communication between among BRICS countries in the near future?
I think that already works. China and Russia trade in the yuan and ruble. Russia and India trade in rupee and ruble. Ruble is now one of those very important currencies. It's the strongest currency in the world all of a sudden. And so there are several messaging systems like BRICS. BRICS is just not BRICS, like SWIFT. SWIFT is just an outdated thing that the Americans control, and that's the issue with it. You know, the Americans control it. But China has its own system. Russia has its own system. Various other countries have systems of their own that they use with the correspondent central banks around the world to exchange messages about payments being made in their own currencies, but completely bypassing, totally opaque to the euro, dollar, etc. system. And that's fine. So why should anybody make stuff like that particularly public? Why should it be a point of discussion for us? You know, money likes quiet, and big money likes super quiet where nobody knows what's going on, especially when it's items like air defense systems from China going to Iran in exchange for oil. Well, we know that that's happening, but how much it's costing in terms of oil and how is that being priced? We'll probably never find out. And that's just the way it should be.
Yeah. Dimitri, did you see the tone of BRICS in terms of condemning the attacks on Iran and Russia sufficient, somehow appropriate, or you, and if not, who was blocking that? It was Brazil, it was India. How do you see the role of Brazil and India in the whole situation, the way that we know that the war between the United States and Russia on one side and Russia and Iran on the other side, they somehow they're going on this sort of fight. It's not finished yet. But how do you find the behavior of Brazil and India in BRICS and dealing with that?
BRICS is not about military matters. Wrong organization. There are other organizations that do meet periodically that might have a bearing on the situation, but BRICS is not one of them.
And you mean SCO is one of them, or ASEAN? And
SCO is pretty much it. So within the format of the SCO, that there have been briefings in Qingdao in China, devoted to what happened to Iran and how to strengthen Iran so that there is no repeat. And also an understanding of the weaknesses that have been exposed of Israel, and since Israel is just a U.S. proxy of the United States, the huge gaps in the air defense systems and their inability to deal with hypersonic rockets, which they do not have, all of that has been discussed to great extent, and it's having a bearing on defense policies of nations around the world, but they're not talking about it publicly, of course.
Here is what the head of Iranian parliament said, Dimitri. He said that at the final stages of the conflict, of the war between Iran and Israel, more than 90% of missiles have hit the targets in Israel. And do you feel that that was the main reason that the United States decided to interfere, that Donald Trump has decided to attack Iran and informing them beforehand?
Well, look, Israelis offered Trump a victory. And then the next thing that happened is Israelis started begging for help because they ran out of air defense missiles. And what Iran did was actually quite funny. They scaled down the size of the attacks because they could achieve the same results with fewer missiles and drones. So why waste resources on an enemy that has been defeated already? The point is not to destroy Israel. The point is to kind of make a point. And Iran definitely made that point. And that point is that Israel and the United States are defenseless against modern Iranian missiles. Defenseless, no matter how you slice it. So once Israel admitted that, then it was time for Trump to, parlay this complete fiasco into a Nobel Peace Prize, which Netanyahu certainly pushed. But that's comedy. You know, that's not war. That's comedy. So you have to draw the line, and it's a very fuzzy line for some people between actual kinetic action and amateur theatricals at the White House. They're different, okay? But the point is that Israel and the United States lost big time.
Donald Trump and Netanyahu had somehow some strange move since Donald Trump took office in Washington. Donald Trump didn't go to Israel. He went to the Middle East, didn't go to Israel. And the Israeli prime minister, it's the third time going to the United States meeting with Donald Trump. Do you feel that the things that we are witnessing at the surface and they're trying that everything's fine between Israel and the United States, between Netanyahu and Donald Trump, is just the way that they're pretending to be, or something behind the scene, some complication, some sort of difficulties are going on behind the scene in terms of the way that Donald Trump sees the conflict in the Middle East and Netanyahu sees it?
Well, I can't get into Netanyahu's brain at all. I'd rather not. He's a horrible man. I can't get into Trump's brain either, except that I know he wants victory, no matter what that happens to mean. He wants that Nobel Peace Prize. You know, he wants parades. He wants people to say his name. It makes him happy when people do that. What's actually happening doesn't really matter. Now, when he went to the Middle East, that was kind of a begathon. Please buy something American, because otherwise our financial system is ruined. That was the tacit message that he gave to all of these rich Gulf Arabs. And they did pony up, or promised to pony up, a couple of trillion, sort of trying to postpone the inevitable crash of the U.S. financial system. But everybody knows it's coming. That's not a secret. So to make sure that those trillions would be forthcoming, he did what he thought would be a nice thing, which is not even talk about Israel. For that trip, for that, you know, little begging thing that he did, Israel did not exist. But, you know, for all, Israel cannot exist without the United States, just like the Ukraine cannot exist without U.S. support. The Europeans won't be able to keep it going at all. That's already clear. And so the U.S. is pulling out from one country after another. So it's basically pretty much threw the Ukraine overboard now. And Israel is probably next.
We know that Donald Trump was not interested in expanding the United States bases and the military power of the United States. They were talking about it before coming to power. They wanted to somehow go into the opposite direction, somehow contracting what has been going on for such a long time. Is that achievable with the attitude that we've been witnessing since Donald Trump took office?
You just made a huge mistake, which is listening to what Trump said before the election. That's called lying like you're running for office. It has nothing to do with what happens after somebody gets elected in the United States. I don't know how it works in Brazil, but there are no ramifications for anyone for lying while running for office. All they have to do is, well, the situation has changed and I don't feel like it anymore. And there's been a complication and, etc. And nobody can do anything about it. You know, instead of throwing somebody in jail for lying in public in order to win an election, that's in America, that's just how it goes. That's just fine. So don't make that mistake. he may have talked about lots of good things, right? All good things for good people. And then once he gets elected, all he wants to do is people to praise him, say his name in public, and give him prizes and flatter him.
It doesn't seem that it was only me and you, or maybe me. It seems that Elon Musk was part of us. he was feeling that Donald Trump would do something different, which it turned out that he was totally wrong, and that's why he's trying to change his mind toward Donald Trump. Is that the case?
Well, I can't get into Elon Musk's brain either, but it's a very probably a very interesting brain. Again, there's a lot of psychiatry going on there. Those two people, each of which thought that he was the alpha male, the top dog, you know, it turned out that there's only one president of the United States, and he changes his mind depending on who kisses up to him last, pretty much. And who controls access to him is some shady characters in the White House. There's some cryptic lady that lets people in or out, and she has her own calculations. So I'm not surprised that Elon Musk, who was promised one thing and was then handed another, kind of had a bit of a psychological problem with that. He should have known better. I thought he was a smart guy.
Yeah, but the system in the United States is much more complicated, Dimitri. You don't have an option. You have to be Republican or Democrat. That's why Elon Musk is trying to do something else, a third party that may function for the American people. We know that you are familiar with the situation with the internal policy of the United States. Do you think if you have someone like Elon Musk, we've seen Mike Bloomberg before trying to do this, but with someone like Elon Musk, is that going to change? Is he going to bring something different to the table that would change the political system of the United States?
Well, look, Elon Musk can't be a Democrat because he smells like Trump. He can't be a Republican because he had a falling out with Trump. And he can't be a third party because there are there's like several hundred third parties or third, fourth, whatever parties in the United States, but they don't matter. They do not matter. They're allowed, but they're not admitted. They do not actually get to participate. If you want to register a party like Elon Musk was trying to do, you have to do it separately in each state. Each state has a different set of hoops to jump through. And most states have a very important hoop, which is you register your party, you collect a zillion signatures on petitions to be admitted on the ballot. And then you are not admitted on the ballot because you have to sit out an election cycle before your party can participate. So you get all these people excited, you register a party, you get their signatures to get you on the ballot, and then it turns out that you have to do it again 4 years later or 2 years later. And by then, you know, the enthusiasm is gone, the money is gone, and you weren't going to get anywhere with this anyway because the whole system has been bought up and divided up between the Republicans and the Democrats, and you're neither, so here's the door, out you go.
Yeah. Donald Trump is frustrated. He said that every time he talks with Vladimir Putin, he's so nice to him, but nothing comes out of this sort of attitude. What does he want? What is the main goal of the United States in Ukraine? Every time they're trying to do something with the United States, Russia is trying to do something with the United States, they put the same sort of terms. Those 33 articles that they put in the P- peace talks in the negotiations with the Ukrainians. They're the same. What do they want differently from what has been said or have been said so far?
Well, look, the Russian attitude is that, you know, you started this war in the Ukraine, you being the Americans, and you're losing it. So, yeah, what do you want? Peace, right? That's funny. Imagine Hitler asking for peace in the spring of 1945. That would have been funny too. So, comedy aside, the United States doesn't really have any options in the Ukraine except defeat. And it's defeat for the United States as the main actor behind the Ukraine, and it's defeat for NATO, and it's defeat for every single European politician who allowed Zelensky to kiss his hand or whatever, which is all of them, and it's called the Ukrainian curse. It has been there since the Middle Ages. Anybody that a Ukrainian leader kisses, you might as well just consider his political career over. It happened to Sweden, it happened to Poland, it happened to everybody since then, it happened to Hitler, and it's going to happen to all of the Europeans who admit Zelensky to their little get-togethers and kiss him on the cheek and promise to give him even more useless weapons, etc. So that's what I think is going on. Now, what Trump wants is something other than defeat. So he's thinking, well, why don't I tell them something? And the Russians are like, no, that's not how it works. Well, I'll talk to my advisors and, okay, here's another plan. And the Russians are, you know, no, that's not how it works. And so he's very frustrated because his advisors tell him, let's make a deal like between North and South Korea, freeze the line of contact. And Putin is like, you know, denazification, demilitarization, neutrality, no foreign troops on Ukrainian soil. How, I don't know what he has to do. Does he have to do an interpretive dance? Does he have to sing an opera aria with those words before it'll register on the brains of the people in Washington? Because he's not going to. He's just basically going to soft-spokenly say the same things over and over again while winning.
It seems, as you've mentioned, the problem with Donald Trump is that he's in a weaker position. He doesn't have the cards to win the game or to play with the game. And he tries to gain some sort of leverage. But as time goes by, his position is not getting stronger, and it's the opposite way. Do you feel that the experience he had during the last 6 months in office would help him to come out and find a solution for Ukraine? Because he knows that the situation is getting worse for the case of Ukraine. And that's why that shows that he's going to be in a weaker position in the next 2 months if he continues the conflict. Is that going to be helpful for him? That he's addicted. He hates to be defeated. He hates the world defeat and being weaker than the party that he's negotiating with.
Well, he wants to portray himself as an alpha male in his own mind. I think he's fragile psychologically, and I think that he could do random bits of damage if his ego was sufficiently damaged. And the Russians are kind of appreciative of that act, and what they're doing is they're holding therapy sessions with him, trying to talk him down. He's sort of a person on the ledge. You don't want to end up forcing him to jump. So the Russians are keeping the conversation over, you know, going, but it's not going to change the outcome. You know, that's just a bit of strategy for the Russians. you know, talk to everybody. But the strategy, the military strategy, is not in any way affected by that.
We had the talks between in Kuala Lumpur, the talks between between Marco Rubio and Sergei Lavrov. And Steve Witkoff is not anymore in the scene. We are not hearing much from him and from what he's doing in terms of the conflict in Ukraine. Do you feel that Donald Trump has been informed on the main position of Russia in Ukraine? That's why Steve Witkoff is not there anymore, that they need to sign something with Russia. That's why Marco Rubio comes to the scene to talk with Lavrov.
I think Witkoff probably got some kind of like a behind the scenes deal with the Russians and everybody else he's talked to. He's a smart guy. He's a businessman. I think he parlayed his relationship with Trump into some newfound sources of wealth. And so he's probably busy with that. I would be if I were him. I wouldn't waste my time on this blah, blah, you know, in Kuala Lumpur. He's probably a happy guy now. He was a pretty happy guy to start with, but now he's double happy.
The situation, we know that Russia is somehow attacking Ukraine, and they're escalating the situation. They're intensifying the attacks. What's going on in the mind of Russia toward Ukraine? I'm talking about on the battlefield, the way the military strategy of Russia.
Well, look, they're in no rush. They're consuming the Ukrainian military. They found some very interesting ways to make themselves intensely loved by the Ukrainian population. And that is to bomb the Ukrainian army recruitment centers. They've been blowing them up. And the Ukrainians have been applauding. Social media in the Ukraine is full of letters of thanks to Putin and all of Russia for destroying their army recruitment centers all over the country. You have to keep in mind that air defense in the Ukraine is done. It's absolutely finished. So the Russians can pretty much destroy any building anywhere in the Ukraine at will, which they do. So this is something that the Russians are doing that will probably not have an immediate effect, but it shows you where it goes. So Ukrainians now love Putin because Putin destroys the army recruitment centers that they're so afraid of, because, you know, there are no volunteers in the Ukraine anymore. They're just conscripts, and they're people grabbed off the streets and not given any training and marched off into quote-unquote battle, which involves sitting in a trench until the Russians kill you. And if you try to surrender to the Russians, which lots of them try to do, then your own Ukrainians will kill you as you try to surrender. And the level to which the Kiev regime has sunk is basically the level of a rabid animal that has to be put down. They aren't even human anymore. What they've been doing lately is burning the corpses of the frozen corpses of the Ukrainian servicemen that the Russians have carefully scraped off the battlefield and returned to the Ukrainians as a humanitarian gesture. And so what the Ukrainians have been doing with those corpses is burning them instead of returning them to the families, because if they return them to the families, they would owe those families reparation money. So to save money, they just burn them instead of giving them a decent Christian burial. They're doing that. Another thing, and another new trend in the Ukraine, is mining the corpses of the dead Ukrainians on the battlefield. The idea is that the Russians will try to get those corpses again, collect them to give them a decent Christian burial, and get blown up because there's a mine under the corpse. They've been doing quite a bit of that. And then since they can't hit any worthwhile target in Russia, they just recently shelled a beach with women and children in Kursk. And a boy heroically died covering his mother from the shrapnel. So that's the kind of country it is now. It's in its death throes. It really needs to be put out of its misery. The sooner the better. And here are these Americans thinking about, well, what kind of a deal can we make with Russia? That word deal, they think that it's some kind of a business relationship. And that's just bizarre, you know, and sick. These are sick people. And so the Russians are playing doctor and being magnanimous in talking to them and trying to talk them down and clarify their thinking. I don't know if that's going to work, though.
What's so amazing, Dmitry, that the way that Donald Trump is trying to gain some sort of leverage over Russia, on the other hand, you see, in my opinion, he didn't gain that much of leverage over Zelensky and his administration in Ukraine. Do you feel that Donald Trump can somehow manage the situation with Ukraine? I'm talking about the Ukrainian side of the conflict. Or you still see Europeans being in charge when it comes to the way that the administration, the government in Ukraine function?
Well, the government in the Ukraine is falling apart. It's fracturing internally. I don't know how long it's going to last, but their only plan, and the only plan of the Europeans, is to outlast Trump and have another, you know, living, talking cadaver like Biden roll into the White House, and everything will go back to the way it was before, which of course won't happen, but you can dream. But that's basically what the Europeans are doing. The Europeans kind of scored a victory, which is that they were excluded from the negotiation between Kiev and Washington, which went famously badly. It fell apart. And now they managed to somehow parlay themselves into some kind of a European role, at least on the level of talking about it. At the meeting in Rome, Giorgia Meloni proposed that the needs for the financial needs for rebuilding the Ukraine should be taken seriously. That the Ukraine is investment grade territory, as she suggested, I suppose, which is a radical break with reality. And that is a kind of typical of what's going on in the Ukraine now. But as somebody who's been kissed by Zelensky, these political leaders are basically dead men walking. Anybody who is kissed by a Ukrainian leader is, by definition, either dead or close to it, or a political corpse at the very least. So they're basically fighting for time.
When Russia talks about the change in the political system of Ukraine, or maybe Zelensky being removed and being replaced by someone else, do you feel that is that going to be helpful for the process of negotiation, for the process of a political settlement in Ukraine? Or if they get someone like Zelensky, I don't know, or some other guys from Ukraine, from the political parties in Ukraine, is that going to solve the situation? Is that going to facilitate the process of negotiations?
Look, there are lots and lots of Ukrainian quote-unquote politicians all over the place. There are at least three different groups of them in Moscow, and they even appear on talk shows talking about how they'll run the Ukraine once the fighting is over. And then there are people in Kiev, there's Zaluzhny, there's all kinds of stuff, typical Ukrainian fashion, talking about what will never be. The Ukraine will not be a country, it will be a territory governed from Moscow. for a long time, it will be governed rather harshly. There will be no rebuilding. And the suggestion will be that people who have something to offer should go to Russia and offer it. If they have nothing to offer, they could go to Europe and beg. And if they want to stick around, they can stick around and grow corn or whatever it is they want to do. Collect fruit from fruit trees when it's in season and bring it to the market. But there won't be any industry there. There won't be any development there. It'll just be some, you know, agrarian remnant. That's how I see its future.
The frozen Russian assets would be part of the negotiation. Are they going to talk about it? Are they going to try to talk about it with the Trump administration, or there going to be some sort of talks between Russia and Europeans?
I don't think the Russians care. Putin recently said that perhaps that money was kind of worth forfeiting in order to destroy the dollar and the euro, which is happening. And that money is in dollars and euros, and those are going away. And so the Russians are fine with that. The ruble is the strongest currency in the world. Russia's reserves are fatter than ever. The Russian economy is slowing down, but it grew by quite a bit during these three, four war years. Everything's fine. Russia is not really going to allow anybody to offer it something that is its own and has been, you know, and you know, as Putin put it, Russia has been robbed. This money wasn't stolen, he pointed out, because theft has to be in secret. If it's not in secret, if it's done publicly, it's robbery. That's a different chapter in the criminal code of the Russian Federation, which applies to the officials who did it. So what negotiation can there be with criminals?
Is the security architecture of Europe still one of the main concerns of Russia, or they don't feel that they can achieve that with the current situation, with what's going on in terms of the leaders in Europe, in terms of the presidents and those people who are running the show in Europe? Is that achievable without Donald Trump being part of, because Donald Trump doesn't seem to have that much of interest in what's going on in Europe. But how about Russia? How does Russia see the future with European countries?
It doesn't. Russia does not see a future with the European countries. Russia doesn't see much of a future for the European countries. Russia does seem to have a bright future for itself and for its various partners around the world, but the Europeans are hostile to Russia and will therefore miss out. As far as the threat that they pose to Russia, it's a fairly minor threat, and the Russians think that they can deal with it.
Yeah. But is that any sort of difference in the mind of Russia when it comes to the eastern or western part of Europe, the way that they can deal with some countries and the other countries is somehow hostile and somehow consider Russia as their main enemy?
I suppose there are nuances there. Russia is always about bilateral relations. At this point, because of the attitude throughout Europe, these bilateral relations are rather tense and are limited to the countries that very much depend on Russia for various things. So Hungary is obviously dependent on Russia for something like 80% of its oil. Slovakia is dependent 100% on Russian oil. And making sure that they're supplied is a Russian priority. Also, there's a nuclear power plant, Paks-2, being built in Hungary, which is a Rosatom project. So the Russians are very interested in that project going forward. So their literal points of reference between Russia and various countries in Europe, not too many anymore, but overall there isn't this thrust of, oh, let's deal with the European Union, let's reestablish diplomatic contacts and and negotiate with Ursula or whatever. There's none of that.
We know that one of the main projects is the north-south corridor between Russia, from Russia going to Azerbaijan, Iran, and then how do you find the way that Russia and Iran are thinking about Azerbaijan right now? Are they going to consider the same sort of strategy as before, or as time goes by and the differences that are happening, or maybe they're trying to deal with Azerbaijan? I don't know what's going on behind the scene, but it doesn't seem that much of understanding on the scene what's going on, as we know in the news. What's going on in the mind of Russians and maybe Iranians when it comes to Azerbaijan and the project? We know the project is huge and very important for both countries, Iran and
Russia. First of all, Azerbaijan doesn't have to be part of that project at all. You know, if it really wants out, it can just like leave, and the north-south corridor will merrily go on as before. There are two other ways of going from Russia to Iran. One is by water over the Caspian. That's a matter of building enough ships quickly enough. The other way is through Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan by rail. And so if Azerbaijan wants to create complications for Russia, it'll lose in the process, because it could charge transit for a huge volume of cargo. If it wants to lose money, fine. But what's going on with Azerbaijan politically right now is rather nasty. You see, there are all these ethnic mafia crooks, Azerbaijani, in Russia, sending money back and politically connected. And the Russians have decided to clean them all out. They're just basically cleaning up these ethnic mafias all over Russia. And it was the turn of the Azerbaijanis to be shown the door or the inside of a prison cell. You know, the door if they're Azerbaijani nationals, the prison cell if they're Russian nationals. That is roughly how it works. Now, there are other things that really peeved a lot of people in Baku, in Azerbaijan. One of them is that they were making lots of money from oil refineries they owned in the Ukraine that the Russians decided to bomb, because those refineries were making diesel that was being supplied to the Ukrainian military, which was not on strategy for Russia. So they bombed those refineries, and Azerbaijan lost that income stream. There were other complications, such as the dealings of Azerbaijan with Israel. It allowed Israel to launch drones from Azerbaijani territory into Iran. Iran is a partner, Russian partner, you know, with security agreements between the two. So that wasn't a nice thing to do. And so that is kind of like a mark against the Aliyev government in Baku. And so overall, what the Azerbaijanis decided to do is turn rabidly anti-Russian. Wrong move, you know. They stand to lose everything. And to begin with, they're losing the tomato trade. What are they going to do with all those tomatoes that were going to Russia before? Poor tomatoes.
You're looking at China and the way, if I were Chinese and sitting in China and seeing what's going on with the United States foreign policy in Ukraine, in the Middle East, do you think that they're feeling much comfortable than before, or they're feeling that the United States is somehow trying to get to China as well, trying to bring the conflict to the Taiwan? How is the situation is going to be felt in China, in your opinion?
China won the trade war with the United States. I don't know how many Americans realize that that's actually what happened, but Believe me, it happened. It was painful. There's no more trade war between the United States and China because China won. And so China is a kind of a separate case where the United States, you know, trades with China in the morning, and then after a few drinks in the evening, talks about starting a war with China, and then wakes up in the morning and does some more trading with China, because and that's how it goes. And the Chinese think, well, okay, you're strange, but your money is still kind of okay, even though we're trying to get rid of it. But the Chinese are pretty much ready to get rid of the U.S. trade at the drop of a hat. If they're smart, that's what they're doing. I don't know how successful they are. They should be preparing.
Dmitry, one of the main issues in the BRICS summit, they asked for unconditional ceasefire in Gaza between Israel and Palestinians. And it's something political. It doesn't have that much of power to, but when it comes to the importance of BRICS, I think the relevance of what they've been talking about, it's important, and it's something to be considered by the United States, by the West. How do you find the situation in Gaza? Israel is trying to make a new prison in the southern part of Gaza, sending all these people. I don't know if that's possible to send 2 million people to that prison and then trying to send them to other countries. Do you think that the way that Netanyahu is trying to deal with Gaza is going to help him?
Help who?
Help Netanyahu and his plan, his sort of strategy. Is that achievable with what's going on?
Well, at this point, killing Palestinians is all he has going on. He can't go up against Iran anymore because Iran can destroy Tel Aviv and various other Israeli cities, the port in Haifa. You know, that involvement was days away from ruining what was left of Israeli industry and Israeli economy. He can't go against the Houthis. They just sank a couple of ships that were going to Israel. So there's a Red Sea blockade that he can't do anything about. Bombing Yemen from the air doesn't work. So what can he do there? And so killing the poor Palestinians is all he can do to keep some kind of a war going. And he has to keep some kind of a war going, because if there's suddenly peace, then he's out of a job, because, you know, he's crooked and everybody knows it. And he can only hold on to that job while there's military action happening. Not very successful military action, I'm afraid. It's just murder. It's just murder.
Thank you so much, Dmitry. Go ahead, Dmitry.
Well, okay, one thing I wanted to add is that BRICS condemning what Israel is doing in Gaza is not what BRICS should be doing. It's the wrong thing to do. That's that kind of useless moralizing should be restricted to the UN.
Yeah.
BRICS should be doing something useful for a change.
It seems that they feel that the UN is not functioning. That's why they try to do it. Condemnation, these condemnations of what's going on with Iran, Russia, in the Middle East, but how they can deal with these things? These are some sort of gatherings, organization, international organization. Many countries are participating in BRICS. They have to talk about these political, geopolitical changes that are happening and may influence the economy of these countries as well.
Well, I don't think that, you know, what they did in terms of taking a moral stance on Gaza, I don't think that that will be effective. Mm-hmm. I think that it will be just more noise.
Yeah. But the how about UN? UN is not functioning. How the I don't know the International Criminal Court somehow cannot go against Netanyahu. Who's gonna help Palestinians if not BRICS?
Nobody. I'm sorry to be so harsh, but nobody is really interested in helping the Palestinians.
Yeah.
It's sad.
It's sad, yeah. Thank you so much, Dmitry, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Thank you. Send me a link. I'm behind the mighty firewall that Google has erected.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Before going, Dmitry, go ahead and let us know about your website.
Oh, yeah, okay. It's boosty.to/cluborlov, C-L-U-B-O-R-L-O-V. Lots of articles for you to catch up on. If you haven't subscribed yet, please go there and subscribe. It's a happening scene. Lots of interesting commentary, too, from readers.
Yeah. See you soon, Dmitry.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.